Good afternoon, and welcome to Animal Voices. My name is Marge Adams. I'll be your host for the next hour. This show is presented through the cooperative efforts of three local groups, Animal Defense and Anti-Vivisection, Vancouver Humane Society, and Earth Save Canada. Opinions expressed on Animal Voices are not necessarily those of these organizations. In the next hour, we'll be hearing from Devin Menke, of the Wildlife Rescue Association. He will be telling us about those attractive little creatures called skunks, who are so prevalent in the Vancouver area at this time. He'll also give a little bit of information on how to avoid being skunked. We'll be hearing from John Pranger of the Animal Defense and Anti-Vivisection Society on the topic, Becoming a Discerning Citizen and Consumer. I'm also hoping that we'll get some listener involvement in the second part of the hour. I've long been intrigued by the idea that species other than humans have sensory perception that we lack. Lately, I've read a few anecdotes about animals who have demonstrated what we usually call extrasensory perception. Have you ever had such an experience that convinced you that an animal has awareness ability that we humans lack? Later in the show, we're going to provide our on-air number and hopefully hear from you. We now have Devin, I believe, on the line. Devin's not quite on the line yet, we'll just spend a moment talking about something. Perhaps we can turn to John.
Well, here's a shocking statistic. Nearly half of all the waters off the coast of the United States are so damaged they can't fully support aquatic life.
Really?
That's from an EPA report of 2002, so it's quite old already, but...
Probably a lot worse now, huh?
I would imagine so.
Yeah, so it's quite shocking. There's been a recent study made of fish farming that I heard about, and claiming that the fish, wild fish, do quite well even in front of a fish farm. Did you hear that one?
No, I hadn't. I'm not
thoroughly convinced of that. It was probably an industry study.
Mm-hmm. This is the young smolts you're talking about. Encouraging the growth of the industry, then, is it?
Well, yes.
Are they performed by our government?
I wonder. Yeah. I'm always suspicious of such things.
No,
yeah. So, we're having a little bit of trouble getting through to Devin at the moment. Perhaps we could have a little music, Alan. No?
CD2. Thank you. now we're waiting to contact Mr. Devon, is it?
Devon Mankey.
Mankey. Mm-hmm. I'll have some commentary. The National Institute of Health of the United States has a predilection for funding non-clinical research, and that's not a new trend, nor is it necessarily a diminishing trend. According to Models for Biomedical Research, which is a title of a report from the Committee on Models for Biomedical Research, scientists conducting research via animal experimentation received greater than 50% of all grant dollars from 1977 to 1983. From 1988 to 1992, the NIH again gave greater than 50% of your money to fund research on animals. And this greater than 50% figure seems constant from year to year. It's difficult to determine exactly how much greater than 50% the actual number is. It could be 51% or it could be 85%. Do we have Devon on the line?
Yeah.
All right, let's go to Devon.
Hello, Devon. Are you there?
Yes.
Oh, hi. This is Marge Adams.
Hi, how are you?
I'm just well, thank you. Now, I know you're going to tell us something about skunks because you've been getting a lot of calls about them lately.
Yes, we have. Every summer it happens, and this one's been particularly busy for skunks. This is the time of year when all the juvenile ones are out of the den and starting to follow mom around and getting into trouble.
And last year was a bumper crop of the young skunks, I understand.
Yes, over the last couple of years, there definitely has been, their numbers have been on the rise around the city.
And is that in all parts of the city, or are there particular parts they like?
It's mostly from where the more population, the more skunks get noticed, I think. So we certainly get a lot of calls from, like, the Vancouver, Burnaby areas, as well as the Surrey and Langley areas are some of the more higher percentage of the calls.
And what are the concerns of people who call in?
A lot of the times it's a little bit of fear. They say, we've seen a skunk wandering through our backyard. We're not sure what to do. We know they spray. We know they smell bad. How can we protect ourselves, protect our children and pets so they don't get sprayed? And there's a lot of more information that they're seeking. What can we do?
Uh-huh.
And then there's certainly cases, too, where they've found injured skunks. So when the young ones are first out of the den and roaming around, there are a lot of ones that get hit by cars,
or
perhaps some of them actually get into trouble with rat traps or things like that. We had one come in this morning that was caught in a rat trap.
Oh dear, it's so disturbing, isn't it?
It is. Yeah.
They're not aggressive creatures, are they?
No, they're not. They're really quite passive, and they would rather get away from you than ever approach you or be aggressive towards you, much more passive than, say, a raccoon.
I see. Okay. And now, why do they spray? Is there something that provokes the spray?
Mm-hmm. The spray is one of their primary defenses, so they will, ideally what they're trying to do is squirt it in the eyes of their predator, and so that it's an acidic spray, and it will actually temporarily blind their predator, and then they can make their escape. So it's strictly sort of a decoy and a disguise so that they can get away.
And they're, of course, very close to the ground, so their predator, they anticipate, is one that's not very tall.
Exactly. Some of the predators are coyotes and, in the city, dogs, for sure, and actually great horned owls prey on skunks quite often.
Ah, yes. Now, is that spray damaging to a human if you got sprayed? I know it would smell terrible, but there's no physical damage from the acidity of the spray, I don't suppose, huh?
Not necessarily. If you take it directly in the eyes, it can cause some burns to your corneas. So is the biggest concern. Certainly, if you get it anywhere near your face, it's recommended you go to the hospital and have them flush really well to make sure there's none left remaining.
But these animals are mainly earth-dwelling. They don't climb trees, or do they?
No, they don't. Yeah, they're strictly, they're diggers. That's one of their favorite pastimes, and how they find their food and how they find their dens is they'll dig under shrubs and under dense bushes. And, of course, around the city, they'll dig under patios and under sheds to find a place to sleep.
And what type of food do they eat?
They're omnivores, so they will roam around basically scavenging for food. They'll eat a lot of roots and grubs as well as things like rodents. They're really good at rodent control.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Hmm. Rats?
Sometimes rats. I think some of the large city rats they might not go after, but certainly the brown rats and small black rats, they would probably prey upon.
Ah, yes.
So they're great for pest control around your house, and if you if you learn to coexist with them, they're actually quite beneficial to people's houses.
I see. And what about the food in the garden? Do they, for instance, I have tayberries in my yard, and I'm wondering if they would be inclined to eat those.
Perhaps. I'm not sure about those the specifics, but yeah, they are, like I said, anything they can sort of dig around, they really get into a lot of trouble when people find them rooting through their gardens. So that's where a lot of human skunk conflicts come from, is they dig up yards, dig up gardens, flowers, berries. Some people with fruit trees, if the fruit has fallen to the ground, the skunks will come by to eat the food that's on the ground.
Do they prowl at night?
Mm-hmm. They are mostly nocturnal. Certainly when the young ones are first active, they're a lot more active than the adults, and they can be seen during the day in the city. But,
Yeah, I had one in my yard. Very attractive little thing.
Yeah, they're pretty cute.
And I would have been tempted to pet him if I hadn't been forewarned about his spraying ability.
Yeah, they can spray almost from day one. So some people think the babies can't spray, but that's a bit of a myth.
They have to turn around, however, to spray, don't they? Mm-hmm. So it takes them a couple of seconds to do that.
Give them a couple seconds. If some of the warning signs are they'll lift their tail is a good sign that they're trying to spray, and also they'll stamp their front feet and give a little growl.
Oh,
so that's a sign of aggression, is they do a little stamp and growl at you, and then the next thing is they'll turn around and squirt.
Ah, well, that's a good idea. I mean, that's a good warning, isn't it? You'd have to be alert to that, of course.
Mm-hmm. And skunks really don't have very good eyesight, being nocturnal. So one thing, if you surprise a skunk, or if you can let kids know, if they surprise a skunk, if they stand really still, the skunk will usually just walk right by them and not even notice them there.
What about the mothers? Are they very protective of their young, and they would be more likely to take exception if you were walking close by? Or
yeah, I think just like any mammal, there's certainly that factor. They will protect their young. They'll be more inclined to get grumpy and spray at you if their young are around than if they were just out roaming themselves.
Uh-huh.
But they're not going to come after you. They'll probably be more inclined to spray more quickly, though.
Oh, yes. So, and do they stay a long time with the mother, or is it just a short, season or something,
I think there have been cases where the young will stay with the mother over the winter, but a lot of times they will also disperse come fall.
I see. Now, I know that when they take up residence on a person's property, that can be disturbing. Mm-hmm. I know that one of our members of program has a family living under his deck or mm-hmm. somewhere. Now, can you tell us about dealing with that?
Yeah, for sure. That's one of our one of the highest volumes of calls we get are from people with raccoons and skunks under their patios and sheds. And there's a couple of things you can do to encourage them to move out. They, of course, look for a dark, quiet spot where they can make their den. And if you take away some of those qualities, so if you can somehow get a light source shining down there, some people set up portable lights or the automotive lights you can sort of push under your deck, and then a portable radio that's tuned to a talk station or something, so there's a continuous sound of human voices, and you can point that down into the area. So then the dark, quiet area suddenly comes lit and noisy. And another thing that works really well is, ironically enough, skunks can't stand the smell of bleach. So you take an ice cream bucket or some yogurt containers and add a couple inches of bleach into the bottom. And it's a good idea to throw a rag in. It helps it evaporate faster.
I see.
And then throw a lid on and puncture some air holes in the lid. And we always recommend taping the lid down so that the skunks or cats and squirrels don't get into it as well. But you're after that constantly evaporating smell of bleach. And if you can make the area where they're denned up smell like that, there's a good chance that they'll just abandon ship and go somewhere else.
Oh, I see. Otherwise, I suppose they'll stay until the end of the season, or
mm-hmm. Into the fall, or potentially over the winter if that's a good spot with lots of food close by.
Because where do they normally den up for the winter?
Again, they'll just find a good spot. It can be under sheds, under patios, somewhere that's going to be enclosed so there's lots of warmth. And sometimes near houses will work great because, of course, there's heat coming off from the house. They do slow down. They go into a semi-hibernation state where they don't eat as frequently, and they're certainly much more lethargic.
Mm-hmm. Now, what are the diseases that may attack the skunk and perhaps get into other species?
Yeah, there's certainly, they can have, like most animals, they can have a variety of roundworms or other parasitical infections that can cause, a host of factors, anything from mild irritation to much more serious conditions. And then there are issues with distemper can get into skunks, as well as, of course, rabies.
And but you don't know whether they're transferable to other species like cats and dogs.
Certainly, if it's the right strain of distemper, it can get into either a cat or a dog. There are the roundworms and stuff are zoonotic, so those can transfer to other species. And then rabies is very, very rare. It's hardly ever seen in skunks in BC, and the cases where it has been seen, it has usually come from bats, which are the primary host in BC.
Oh, yes, and there was a case of that a couple of years ago in Stanley Park, wasn't there?
Yes, that's correct. Yeah, there was a whole, I believe it was almost a whole family of skunks that contracted and succumbed to rabies.
Oh, yeah. Now, what about the population? Do you envision it increasing in this area or not?
They will reach a bit of a bit of a plateau, certainly, as they are territorial, so they will exclude other skunks. So there will be sort of a population cap at some point. I think we're still reaching that, though, and, of course, the more houses and sheds and compost piles there are for them, they're going to continue to expand. So it's certainly, you know, you can take steps to ensure that if they're not welcome at your house, they'll go off and exclude others elsewhere. So there is going to be, at some point, the population will plateau, but I couldn't say if we're there or not.
The usual reason it plateaus is because of the shortage of food.
Mm-hmm. Shortage of food and available territory and, on occasion, predation. But with skunks, I don't think that would be a major issue.
Yeah. Now, John has a question for you, Devin.
Now, the skunk is itself a rodent, isn't it?
It's not part of the rodent family. It's more closely related to cats. They're almost like an insectivore face. So they don't have the large incisor teeth that, let's say, a rat or a squirrel would have. So they're more feline-like.
But the offspring are pups, aren't they?
Yeah, you can call the offspring pups or kits, but it's more semantics.
I see. And they're big enough to hunt rats?
Yeah, the large adult skunks could potentially. I mean,
and quick enough
the large introduced rats, probably not, but certainly the black rats, the smaller rats, for sure.
They're pretty fast moving, so is a skunk then, is it?
Yeah, the skunk, it can be quick. Mm-hmm. Again, it isn't, as you see them walking, especially the really fat ones around town, they aren't the quickest animal. Most of the rodents they're going to get are ones that might, either they'll discover a den or they'll discover the young, a nest, per se, because they're really good at rooting around and digging, and they have a really good sense of smell.
Well, I see lots of rats in the city in the middle of the night, so there's lots to hunt there.
Exactly. And then all those rats have to have their own babies somewhere, and the skunks are good at finding those locations.
Now, our friend who has skunks has them actually under his front door stoop.
Mm-hmm.
And he doesn't mind them. He actually was feeding them. And I guess, is there a way to minimize the impact? I think he even has a face-to-face with them now and then.
A lot of the city urban skunks aren't so quick on the trigger when they see people because they've lived around their houses. And especially there are people who don't mind them living under their house. They have a little bit of an odor, but unless they actually spray, it's not very bad. So some people, as I said, they'll keep the yard free of a lot of pest species. They're pretty good to have around in some cases.
Now, a raccoon might sort of make a big mess out of your attic.
Raccoons are much more destructive. They're more curious. They're more agile. They'll actually climb up on things. They'll get onto your roof. They'll get into raccoons are notorious for coming through open doors and into people's houses because they're more bold than a skunk would be.
Yeah. Thanks.
Yeah, no problem.
Now, Devin, if one of our listeners spotted a skunk in distress, perhaps had been injured, as we mentioned earlier, is it a possibility that the Wildlife Rescue Association will come out and pick up that skunk?
We would certainly get them in here. A lot of times with mammals, we're a nonprofit organization, and we don't have funding for a proper rescue team. So we work pretty closely with the SPCAs in the different municipalities, and so if you see an injured skunk that is in mobile, can't get away, and you can certainly give us a call here, but a lot of times we will just ask you as well to call the SPCA for your city or the Humane Society for your city, and they will, we work pretty closely with them, like I mentioned, so they'll get them in to us.
Good. Now, just before we leave you, Devin, would you mind just telling us once again what the public should do to protect themselves and the skunks if they happen to come in contact with one?
Yeah, certainly, being aware if there's skunks in your neighborhood, making a bit of noise while you're walking around so that you don't surprise a skunk and cause it to spray, and being aware, especially towards dusk and at nighttime, that's when they're going to be around. And then certainly you can take precautions. If you don't want skunks to come under your patio or under your shed, if you take some a thick hardware mesh you can buy at hardware stores, and you can dig that into the ground, because they're really good diggers, you have to put it about a foot into the ground. But if you put that line the areas around your sheds and patios with skunks, there's a lot more easier and natural spots for them to go. And then certainly, like I said, if they're already under there, you can take the steps I mentioned with the bleach, the light, or the radio noise to evict them before you patch up the holes.
Good. Now, can you give us the number of your organization in case anybody wants further information?
Certainly. It's the Wildlife Rescue Association of BC, and our telephone number is 604-526-7275. And we have more information on our website as well, which is www.wildliferescue.ca.
Good. That's wonderful. Thank you so much. Oh, and one final, we have a website also, and John is the webmaster.
Oh, great.
He was checking on the spelling of your name, and I wasn't sure how you spelled Devin.
Could sure, it's D-E-V-I-N.
Mankey,
M-A-N-K-E-Y. M-A-N-K-E-Y.
Okay.
A-Y?
M-A-N-K-Y.
Oh, K-Y. Okay.
Great. Thank you so much for being with us, Devin. We really appreciate it.
All right.
Bye-bye. You have been listening to an interview with Devin Menke, who is a full-time wildlife rehabilitator with the Wildlife Rescue Association, which is located in Burnaby. You are listening to CFRO 102.7 on your FM dial, and this is Animal Voices. Now, Alan, could we have a little music, please?
Listening to Animal Voices, and my name is John Pranger, and I'm reading to you from a book by Doctors Greek and Greek, Sacred Cows and Golden Geese, and the byline is The Human Cost of Experiments on Animals. In 1986, the president of the Institute of Medicine cautioned that medical research was leaning too heavily on basic animal experiments and not enough toward clinical observation. And he called it an emperor has no clothes scenario, meaning that no one among the powers could declaim any animal experimentation for fear of jeopardizing their own power base. According to the Institute of Medicine survey, the National Institutes of Health gave only 15% to 17% of total grant money in 1990 and 1991 to research that could be regarded as human clinical research, and that this included research with human cells and tissues from which so much can be gleaned is disheartening indeed. Furthermore, only 4.5% of grants given the 1990-91 year went to lab research involving humans. This means, again, that National Institute of Health-funded research on animals hugely outdistanced human clinical research. I'm just going to skip ahead a little bit and tell you about some Department of Defense funding. Numerous experiments, but here's a few. From the Department of Defense Biomedical Research Database in 1994, And all of these experiments attempted, really, to mimic information already known and exemplified in human beings. Somebody got $23,000 to extend a previous model of battle fatigue in hamsters and extending that to rats. So they're studying battle fatigue in hamsters. Now, isn't that something? I wonder how in the hell you do that. But never mind. Somebody's got the brains. And somebody got $74,942 to test acupuncture and drugs in ferrets that are routinely used to control vomiting in drugs. That is to say, the drugs used to control vomiting in drug in humans, routinely, that is to say, it's been established as a medical fact that it controls vomiting, they have to test it out in ferrets. And the government gave somebody $74,000 to test the effects of the drug Motilin in dogs that have undergone experimental abdominal surgery, $17,000. Somebody got $395,000 to demonstrate the effects of a chemical warfare agent's antidote in monkeys. And somebody got $626,000 to evaluate the potential of vitamin E to reduce nicotine-associated periodontal destruction in rats. Now, isn't that fascinating? To study vitamin E, so that first they give the rats rotten teeth somehow, then they feed them vitamin E to see if that'll cure them, and they get $626,000 to do it while people go starving in the streets. $136,000 to determine if nutrients alleviate stress in rats. Well, who wants to know that? Well, the government wants to know, and they're prepared to pay $136,000. $232,000 to test the efficiency of drugs on dogs and primates that are irradiated until they vomit and bleed. Nice work if you can get it. And that's the sort of thing that goes on under the name of medical research and medical science. So how do we become discerning citizens and consumers? Well, the powers that be lull even animal lovers into reluctant support with their claims perpetrated through the media. The media routinely reinforces white coat capers with uplifting articles about mouse cancer cures and rats with lowered cholesterol and drugs that look like they will alleviate neurologically devastating diseases like multiple sclerosis or Alzheimer's in mice. These are news. They sell papers and they capture public sentiment. No one ever seems to get around to confirming when or if humans will benefit from these rodent-based revelations, but that's not important, I guess. Further, the animal experimenter's public relations engine pounces on any and every opportunity to keep their position in spin. In a recent example, the media quoted Paul McCartney as saying that his wife's cancer medications had to be tested on animals. Well, taken out of context, this appears to be an endorsement of animal testing by a celebrity whose wife's illness seems to have changed his own known aversion to vivisection. Well, in actuality, of course, McCartney's position against lab animals' use is stronger than ever. The medications Linda McCartney took had to be tested on animals because the law required them to be, not because doing so made the medication safe for human consumption, as the vivisectors were trying to insinuate. The animal experimentation front and the media will always be accurate as long as regulations demand animal testing in saying that drugs were tested on animals. For reporters and for the public that is uninformed and as to the deceptive role of animal testing, this is too subtle a point. This subtlety works to the benefit of the vivisectionists and makes the job of outspoken critics such as McCartney very difficult. In the area of science and medicine, most reporters, though not all, are either uninformed or biased, or both, in their interpretation of the facts of animal experimentation. To be fair, they too were brought up and live in a society that perpetuates the animal model delusion. Very few have the background and expertise to discern what is meaningful. Reporters cultivate and mine relationships with their favorite scientists, ask their opinions, and report accordingly. People like Dr. Greek may grant interviews to the media, and he finds that most don't understand the problem, nor do they have the time to allow these anti-vivisectionist doctors to explain it. J- just as is true in science, the pace, pressure, and money machine of journalism doesn't allow in-depth reporting and exposés that may endanger advertising. Soundbites seldom do justice to science. So it's not easy for the layperson to get his or her hands on comprehensive information. And without a loud public outcry, the animal testing machine, now large and in perpetual motion, will be difficult to stop. Anytime animal testing is questioned, there are outcries from many vested quarters. Scientists, physicians, hospitals, bureaucrats, pharmaceutical companies, medical conglomerates, politicians, animal farmers and vendors, lawyers, news media, all pile up, all hasten to shore up their positions and keep clear of litigation. This interdependency between these various constituencies works like a finely tuned ruse. The more animal experiments the researcher does, the more articles get published. And the more articles he publishes, the more grant money he receives. And the more grant money he receives, the more money the university receives. And the more money the university receives, the better its reputation. The better its reputation, the less liable big business is when the university safely tests its new product, and hence the more products they can sell. The more big business sells, the more money, the more big business sells, the more money for advertising, and hence the more compliant is the media. And on the other side of this cabal is the unwitting consumer paying through the nose for, at best, nothing, and at worst, ill health. It's not a conspiracy, it's just greed. Trillions of taxpayer and charity dollars continue to funnel into wasteful experiments which are of no use to the consumer who supports them. In fact, they're damaging. And that is why Dr. Greek calls animal experimentation white coat welfare. So we have to shake our tacit acceptance of all animal-based medical research. The public, who is both benefactor and would-be beneficiary, has to demand human solutions to our health dilemmas. Are these professionals somehow exempt from the criteria that govern the rest of us? Would your employer allow you to be this unproductive and remain on your job? We don't have unlimited time, money, and scientists. Even if we did, research on animals would still be bad because of all the misleading data and human suffering it creates. If the trillions of dollars wasted on the animal model had instead gone to human-based alternatives, who knows what could have been accomplished by now. In this era of budget constraints, science should focus on experiments more likely to yield tangible benefits to humans. We consumers should demand applicable results. Why support animal experimentation when other methods provide real avenues to better health? We'll be back in a minute.
Thank you for that, John. You're listening to a reading by John Pranger, our animal defense and anti-vivisection representative on this program. You are listening to CFRO 102.7 on your FM dial. This is Animal Voices. Now, to get to the next part of the program, which, remember, is on extrasensory perception in non-human species, I'd like to present a couple of very short stories. Following that, we're hoping to hear from you with your experiences that have convinced you animals have sensitivities which humans lack. And I'll give you the on-air number, which will be open very shortly. The number is 604-684-7561. 684-7561. Now, the first story I have is from a collection assembled by the BCSPCA and published in a book entitled I Learned to Speak Dog. And the story is by Sharon Rondell, and it's called Snooper. On March the 27th, 1986, my uncle, who lived on the Sunshine Coast, was in perfect health for a 75-year-old man. That night, he phoned his ex-wife long distance in the middle of the night to tell her he was upset and unable to sleep because he had been awakened three times by a loud breathing sound coming from the corner of his bedroom. My aunt thought a while. Where did Snooper used to sleep? Snooper was my uncle's beloved sheepdog, his companion of 17 years who had died a few years earlier. My uncle replied, "Well, come to think of it, that was Snooper's special corner." Feeling somewhat comforted, he went back to bed, undisturbed for the rest of the night. 2 days later, we were shocked to learn my uncle had died suddenly of a heart attack. There is not one member of our family who to this day doesn't believe that somehow, some way, old Snooper had returned from the other side, perhaps to be there to help my uncle across. Now that I would call an ESP kind of story. I also had an experience in Davis, California, when I was there many years ago now, and on the University of California campus. There was a big friendly dog who came every day to the campus. He spent all morning and afternoon welcoming students. Almost always he could be found in and around a pool directly in front of the administration building, which was the heart of the campus. He loved wading in the water under the spray of the fountain. And sometimes the students would put detergent in the water, which really got the ire of Ludwig, that was the dog's name, Ludwig's ire up, and he would spend the day wading through the clouds of detergent suds and barking all day long. Terrible. Now, Ludwig's home was several blocks from the campus, but somehow he knew when classes were in session, and he only came to the campus on those days. He would never appear on a Sunday or a holiday. Now, even his companion person, who was asked by a reporter and reported in the local paper how he knew which days to come to campus, she did not know either. And so that it seemed as though he had a sensitivity to the days of the week and the days on the calendar, which I thought was quite remarkable. Now, I would like to encourage you to call in and tell us stories that you have. I think that there are a lot of these kind of remarkable stories about ESP matters. Now, if we have a few minutes here before we get a call, I'd like to refer to another one. Now, this one is about Bruce. He was a Spitz, a dog about town, when my family lived in Nanaimo in early 1920s. He was a free spirit. He roamed far and wide. He had a strong feeling for his family's welfare and seemed to feel that he had to help provide food. This caused my parents a great deal of concern when Bruce would come home with chicken eggs and leave them unbroken on the back porch. My mother feared that someday he would become the target of an angry chicken farmer with a shotgun. In the summer of 1926, my family moved to Vancouver. One hot afternoon in mid-July, Mrs. Lyon, our next-door neighbor, was over visiting, sitting on the top step at the front of our house with me, a six-month-old baby, on her lap. About 100 yards away along our street, men were clearing land for the construction of some retail stores. There were some very large stumps in the property since it had been logged not too many years before. The common practice at that time was to blast the stumps out and then burn them. Suddenly, Bruce appeared, running at top speed, coming from the direction of the land clearing. Up the front stairs he raced with hardly a pause, grabbed me by my diapers and dragged me through the open front door, down the hall, into the kitchen, and under a day bed in the corner. Mrs. Lyon screamed to my mother that the dog had gone mad and attacked the baby. In the midst of all this yelling and confusion, there was a sharp crack of an explosion, followed moments later by the crash of something striking the roof. It shook the house to the foundations. A large piece of tree stump was embedded in the shingles. Recalling the incident later, my parents wondered how Bruce knew that this particular charge was dangerous. Blasting was a common occurrence in Nanaimo. The crew had blasted stumps on various days, and Bruce was in the vicinity. Why did this one alarm him? Now, did he have some extrasensory perception that allowed him to see the future and fear for the safety of that baby?
That's extraordinary.
It's amazing.
And
there are quite a number of such stories that seem to be popping up now amongst my reading.
Wow.
Now, Alan, do we have someone on the line? Yes. Please go ahead.
I'm Jenna, and actually my cat just meowed here, so she's very happy to be subject of the ESP.
Hello.
Hi. So, did you hear that meow?
Yes.
Yeah, she's very psychic. So one day I was about 3 blocks from home, and I had a new cell phone, and it went off when I was on my bike. So I stopped my bike and talked on the phone, and I suppose the sound of my voice carried and the unusual quality of being on the cell phone, and I looked down, and 3 blocks from home, there's little Mellow, who's not meowing now, even though I'm blowing on her. So it's kind of interesting that she seems to know when I'm needing her and when to appear. Very psychic cat. I've been away, and they always say that the cat knows when you're coming back. They tend to come to the door, and at the cat sitter's house and wait for me.
Yeah, do you think that they sense your presence much more, or your presence in a greater distance than we're able to, or do you think that they somehow know that it's a routine and they know how to tell time somehow?
No, I heard Rupert Sheldrake that says, you know, the mind goes beyond the actual physical form, and I believe that with cats as well as people, and there's an aura or a sensory field.
Or mental body.
Yeah, well, there's thoughts. So when I'm really strongly thinking about her, or even when I'm in need, you know, she senses that beyond the actual physical.
Interesting. Now, that's a very occult idea of the mind sending out thought forms.
There's another little squeak from her. Yes, I believe that. Because I think that, you know, I've been told it is a sense that we can transmit our brainwaves through time and space, that... Mm-hmm. If we are doing it with the right intention and the right energy, rather than out of true dependence, but just out of love and you know, a sense of lightness.
Have you noticed this with other animals that you've had, Jenna?
I knew when I grew up with George it was like that. I've only had cats, so I can't say. I believe dogs could be probably more so, because you've always heard about dogs who know when the owners moved, like across the country, they know when to show up.
Yes.
Well, cats will do the same, won't they?
Yes,
and
they
travel
will.
Vast distances in unknown territory.
My cat is quite, you know, she's very, very aware of, you know, what I'm doing in life. You know, she's really listening intently, whereas sometimes I'm on the phone and she couldn't be bothered. And she's...
We had a cat who loved to watch television, but the only program she would watch was The Nature of Things.
Oh, interesting.
Amazing, yeah.
Yeah, they're very smart animals. It's a real joy to when a person is looking for the animal, and, you know, I'll tend to know exactly where she is, like when she's outside, and there's, you know, 1,000 places she could be.
Mm-hmm.
And there she is, you know, on the side of the house or across the street. Like, I'll know exactly where she is. So it's quite a joy.
Yeah, it's strange, isn't it? Sometimes you look into the animal's eye and you just sort of try and understand what they're thinking, because they obviously have thoughts of their own.
They do. They have mood. You can see the look, of course, fear, but love, too, and they're smiling and they have a contented look.
Yes.
Now, cats
mm-hmm.
are thought of as particularly psychic, aren't they, by many people?
They are, especially mm-hmm. writers. Writers used to say that the cat, I believe was at the Buddha or the one of the great, somebody like Buddha said he was writing, and, you know, he was in the monk robes, and his cat was perched on his arm of the cloth of the arm, where his arm was, and the cloth, you know, the cat had perched there, and Buddha was afraid to lift his arm up, so he just rested for 2 or 3 hours until the cat was ready to move. He just sensed that, you know, his cat was very good for him while he did his writings.
Oh. Oh,
soothing.
Yeah, soothing, and also...
Inspiring, maybe.
Inspiring, and, you know,
and
I
feeling
actually,
of love, yeah, that would between the two.
She's trying to get it anyway. So I was very pleased to hear your show. It's very informative, and especially with the skunks and the anti-vivisection, it's very informative. So thank you for having me.
Well, thank you so much for calling, Jenna. We really appreciate it.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Now, I'll repeat the number for you. I hope more of you have stories to tell. 604-684-7561.
Now, that book that you have there, God's Messengers, why does the author call it God's Messengers? Any idea?
Well, I think that there's a connection. Many of these stories are connected with the wonders of dogs and how they accomplish great feats in saving their companions, the companion humans, for example.
Very
And it's they're acting like the messengers of God, doing what God would like to see happen, or even as communicators with God.
Like angels that protect us.
Exactly.
Some people experience that.
Like this snooper who's going to be the guide for his companion going across to the other side.
Do you think animals pass over, or the souls of animals pass over in the same way that the souls of humans pass over?
Well, I don't have a great, you know, feeling for that. I'm not really inspired in such things. But I certainly have read that these companion animals do live in heaven with their ex owners, as we call them. Mm-hmm. Yeah, mm. Yeah. So that it's a puzzle to me, but I'm interested in it. I enjoy it. Now, there's some other caller on the line. Hello.
Hello.
Yes. What is your name?
My name is John Mitchell.
John Mitchell.
Yes.
Hi, John. Pleased to have you on the show.
Yes.
And have you had an experience that
Well, what I wanted to tell you was I've, at my wife's urging, I listened to your program now for a couple of years. And when I first listened to you, I thought it was an awful lot of nonsense. But after 2 years, you've quite convinced me. And I really feel quite supportive of what you're trying to do and of your philosophy.
Wonderful.
And, so there it is. I really wanted to express how much I appreciate what you're doing, and I do support it.
Well,
thank you very much.
You persisted persisted in listening to something for 2 years that you didn't really like.
Yes, and you've convinced me.
And so now you're looking for compassion for all animals and helping. That's
well, you're a patient man. Thank you.
Thanks very much for what you're doing.
Bye-bye. Now,
occult philosophy talks about a septenary universe and that everything is structured in a sevenfold manner, and that parts of us and other living beings, but that includes the rocks, the mineral kingdom, the vegetable kingdom, the animal kingdom, the human kingdom, the angelic realms, that each part lives on a separate plane. There are seven planes of the universe and seven cosmic planes and subplanes and various things. The human soul lives on one plane. The human spirit on a higher. The mind on a third plane, a third from the top actually. Mm-hmm. And then the emotional and so on, and the psychic energies, all existing on these planes. And all creatures share in that structure. So animals have a soul very much as we do, because it's simply a being on a certain plane, though not as active perhaps as it is in the human being.
Is this a hierarchy that we're talking about,
yes,
from the angelic down to the minerals?
I think so, yeah.
Really?
Maybe that's a very heretical idea in the face of materialistic science, but it's I think it's one that's much adapted to the Aquarian age, and I think it will gain currency as time passes.
Well, I take a somewhat materialistic point of view towards things, but nonetheless, I agree in a sense with what you're saying, in that I don't see any difference between human beings and other animals. And we're all animals on the planet Earth, right? Mm-hmm. And whether you're talking about a person or a bear, a human or a bear or a raccoon or a snake or a fish in the ocean, we're all animals on the planet Earth, and we all are doing the same thing. And our species happens to specialize in a certain way, which makes us, unfortunately, much more powerful than other animals, and we impose our will on other animals. But there isn't any essential difference. And however, you can have a philosophy like you were talking about and see the universe is divided into different planes and so on. But ultimately, the point is that there isn't any difference. And And we should respect other animals the same way we respect other human beings. There isn't any difference. And we create an artificial difference for there's numerous historical and cultural reasons. Some cultures don't, I should say. And we started off the show today playing a piece of recording of whale sounds. And it's interesting because it's a locally recorded whale sounds. And the local First Nations people, when they used to go out and catch whales, they realized that they were taking another creature that was equal to them, and they respected the fact, and they would thank the whale for giving, sharing the whale's life with them, right? Mm-hmm. And they'd have all these ceremonies and so on, and they would never kill a creature without, or eat a creature without understanding what they were doing, and that they were taking the life of something else to sustain themselves. And but our culture has kind of lost, very much lost touch with that, that sense of equality between species, and the fact that we are just one species amongst many, many species, and no species is more important or, you know, better or anything else, right?
Yeah, the trouble is we don't respect the other as being equal, do we? We're the peak, and then the rest are all beneath us, so it's okay to eat them, for example.
A lot of that comes from the Judeo-Christian tradition, I think, and mm-hmm. this misunderstanding of Genesis. But, you know, this septenary universe also means that the fourth plane is a balance, and that's where man resides. And the myth of Adam eating of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil is the age, the symbolism of man's of the spark of fire, which is mentality. It comes into the human being, and he becomes technological. He creates fire and so on. This myth, the Greek myth of fire stolen from Jupiter by Prometheus, was then punished, of course, by being chained to the rock. And the same as Adam is cursed by a Yahweh, who has made him this unconscious creature, but he suddenly becomes conscious because he eats of this knowledge, or the tree, which provides the discriminating knowledge between good and evil. And so man always has this choice of ascending upwards or being pulled downward by his own desire. And there is where our feelings are. And now man has so much power in our day and age that we're at a crisis point, and we're going to have to make a very, very stout resolution to ascend rather than descend into a destruction of this whole world.
Yeah, unfortunately, we're destroying everything else with ourselves, right? Yeah. That's a big tragedy.
Right, yeah. Increasing our numbers and doing things like producing armaments and bombing other countries and all this. We seem to knowingly go out to destroy our nest, don't we?
Yeah, and unfortunately, we just see it happening around all the time, like the announcement by the provincial government the other day that they're going to allow hotels to go in provincial parks. Now, these parks are really important because they provide space for the other animals in British Columbia. That's the wildlife. I mean, the big animals, the mammals, but also the birds and the insects and the other small creatures that
right.
need a place to live. But if you just get rid of all the parks and you turn them all into resorts, and you have nothing but roads and ski slopes and so on, you're just it's bad enough we take all the space we do, but at right now in British Columbia, 13% of the property, the land, is set aside as wildlife areas, as reserves, as parks. But unfortunately, we have people running the show here in Victoria who just don't get it, right? They just don't see why you have a park. The park is not there for, ultimately, primarily for human recreation. The park is there to set a part aside that we will leave as, you know, the natural environment, right? And so the plants and animals that are originally here, that are part of this part of the world, can continue, right?
And it seems that all their policies are slowly encroaching on all the wild places. It's drilling for oil in the Strait.
Mm-hmm.
Now we hear too of selective logging again in parks. And, you know, I mean, this is just slow encroachment. Oh my God, I have a chore to do, which is to burn the program for the next program.
Okay, so we'll hold the fort while you're doing that, Tom.
And now, Alan, you talked earlier before the program about not being convinced that animals have extrasensory perception from extra senses, but that they simply are more aware in some areas.
Yeah, well, clearly, like all creatures, all species of animals have their own ways of specializing. And with us, it's our big brain, man, the tool maker, and our ability to do certain types of things. But other, like dogs, have this incredible sense of smell, right? Like 1,000 times better than humans. You know, like I read once, like a dog smells in landscapes. The way we are quite visually oriented, and we see a landscape and we look somewhere. A dog smells a landscape, like they smell things that we don't smell, and other, like many birds. hear things we don't hear, and other animals have very superior senses that, you know, that we don't have, a use of certain senses. We hear pretty well and we see pretty well, but not as well as other animals. Mm-hmm. And so they can pick up cues that we can't pick. A dog can smell things that there's no way we can smell. Not only can he smell in much more detail, but he can smell many more things than we can. And we are giving off all kinds of odors all the time. And so somebody who's ill gives off certain odors. Some doctors and some schools of medicine use smell as part of their diagnostic process. Well, an animal like a dog can smell like somebody who's ill. And they can smell many things, and that makes them aware of things that we cannot be aware of. And the same with animals that hear very well or see very well, and so on. It's like I don't see it as extrasensory perception. It is just a very increased sensory perception.
Right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. The only trouble is, you know, I've tried to think about an extra sense, and I can't do it. I'm wondering, is this a human lack, perhaps, that we are not capable of? Think of anything that isn't somehow limited as we are. So they can't just think of more of the same, but something different. I'm afraid I can't do that. And maybe there are other wise people who are able to. But this idea of communication to the afterlife, I think that's probably as close as.
Well, if you believe in an afterlife, right?
Yeah.
I mean, some of us have a little difficulty in mm-hmm. accepting the notion of an afterlife, and so that's a non-starter. I mean, and so but I don't need to understand those things in those terms. Understand, you know, the sanctity of life and the importance of respecting other people and other creatures and so on without thinking in theological terms. Mm-hmm. Though, I mean, it's a matter of philosophy, you know, my philosophy and somebody else's, but...
I'd be interested in knowing of an extra sense that would be a possibility for any creature. Anyway, Alan, I guess we're just about out of time.
Yeah, we have to wrap things up.
Yeah, so thank you for listening. This is CFRO 102.7 on your FM dial, and you have been listening to Animal Voices, a weekly program presented every Friday from 12 to 1 p.m. Thank you.